All your favorite CBC podcasts are now available on YouTube. The best in award-winning true crime investigations, hilarious comedies, vibrant pop culture conversations, and even more audio series are all available on CBC Podcast's YouTube channel. You'll also find exclusive video first episodes, YouTube shorts, and behind-the-scenes content from our hosts and producers that you can't find anywhere else. So if YouTube is your go-to source for podcasts, just search CBC Podcasts and hit subscribe, and you'll never miss the latest update.
This is a CBC podcast.
The following episode contains difficult subject matter. Please take care while listening. I'm Kathleen Goldhar. This is Crime Story. Every week, a new crime with the storyteller who knows it best.
I always thought, oh no, I'm a national security reporter who does difficult Guantanamo Bay stories and other stories that have nuance, and I don't tell the very simple narratives. But I was drawn to this story because it was a simple narrative. You know, it was a classic young kid hero.
There are certain things that I miss about getting a newspaper delivered to my door every morning. One of those things is the impact of the front page picture. And there are a few I will always remember, including the first time I saw a Michelle Shepard shot of a 17-year-old Ismail Abdul. Sitting on a simple straight-back chair, the young man with soulful eyes looks straight into the lens. His eyes are so piercing that at first you don't notice the rest of him. But eventually you take it in. His right hand and his left leg have been cut off by the terrorist group Al-Shabaab.
I could barely focus the camera because my eyes were tearing up. And it was just kind of the barbarity of this war that I'd covered for so long was really bearing down in that moment.
Michelle took that first picture of Ismail in 2010. And over the course of a decade, the story she told about him, how he lost his hand and foot, changed, causing Michelle to ask, what stories are told? Why do we tell them? And who gets to do the telling? All of it went into a feature documentary called The Perfect Story. Michelle, welcome to Crime Story.
Thanks, Kathleen.
Okay, first major disclaimer.
We are friends.
We are. Yes. Yeah, you were one of my best friends. We met in journalism school, yeah. And we do tend to spend a lot of time together. So this is going to be an very unbiased or biased interview. Also, we've worked together on a number of podcasts. So let's just put that out there that we know each other really well.
You got
really
me into podcasting. Yes.
That's right. Okay. But let's talk about Ismail then. Tell me, how did you meet him?
So it was in January 2010. And at the time I was working for the Toronto Star, I was a foreign correspondent and I covered Somalia quite a bit, actually. It was a great time to be a foreign correspondent. We had money that they don't quite have anymore these days. And Somalia was one of the areas I covered, in part because my beat as a national security reporter was looking at things that happened after 9/11. But Somalia was also a really important story for Canadians, because outside of Africa, Toronto, or Canada, but Toronto in particular, has the largest diaspora. So I was always completely connected when I went there. Like, I've lost track, but over the years, I think maybe two or three prime ministers in Somalia were Canadian, the head of the police, the head of the intelligence. So, you know, everybody who came here early in the 90s, there was a very powerful diaspora. A lot of them went back to try and help rebuild the country. And so being a Canadian, working for the Toronto Star, really helped me get in and get connections.
And what was going on in Somalia? Like, why was it such a focus for you?
It was, it has been sort of years of war there. But in particular, around that time, there was a group that was connected to Al-Qaeda. And since 9/11, I'd been covering all the Al-Qaeda groups and their splinters. So Al-Shabaab had risen to power during a period of civil war there. And then by that time, when I met Ismail, they had joined with Al-Qaeda.
And you met Ismail. So tell me about how that happened. Who was he? How did you meet him?
Yeah, it was through a contact, actually a Canadian contact, who worked for the justice minister there. And I was on a trip. It was a time when it was very difficult to move around Somalia. So I was essentially embedded. I was with the African Union forces. We had to drive around in these massive armored vehicles called Caspiers. We were in, you know, flak jacket, helmet, and you had to have this security to get around. But a contact of mine who worked for the justice minister said, listen, I have someone I really need you to meet. Can you get over here? So I convinced my escorts that I needed to go do this interview. I remember they were none too pleased because it was getting close to curfew. We couldn't be on the streets late. So they're like, okay, but you don't have long. So we race over there to this area and I walk in and there's actually four young men and they're sitting there and each one is missing a hand and a foot. And they've sought refuge in this government compound. Almost as soon as I got there, the guards are like, okay, we got to go. It was a terrible situation to try and do an interview. So I went over and I started talking with them through a translator. They all spoke Somali. And it was Ismail who came forward. He was the youngest. He was so eager to tell his story. And he couldn't talk fast enough, telling me everything that happened. And then right at the end, as they're screaming, you got to go. I'm like, okay, I need to take a picture. And he did the picture that you spoke about. He just walked over. He grabbed a chair, very naturally, like took off his prosthetic hand and foot and folded his legs in such a way and just stared at the camera. And I remember I could barely focus the camera because my eyes were tearing up. And it was just kind of the barbarity of this war that I'd covered for so long was really bearing down in that moment. And it was really difficult. And there was this terrible power imbalance. Here I am in, you know, my flak jacket and helmet with these guards. And here's this 17-year-old in his sarong missing a hand and a leg. And so that's when I met him. I raced out of there. My final image of him is he looked at me and he pointed to a Canadian pin on my bag. And so I was like, wow, you want this pin? Sure. Gave it to him. And he dropped it. And my final image was him like trying to find the pin. And anyway, went back in, got back before curfew, went back to Nairobi, wrote the story. And I think by that point, I was starting to get a little, you know, a little cynical about foreign reporting. You write these harrowing stories and kind of nothing happens. You know, that you come back and you get that kind of, I think there's a term for it, it's called moral injury when you do these kind of stories that you come back and you start to think, I'm not making a difference. It's not changing anything.
Yeah, I mean, I think we all go through that. I always say like the one time that I felt like I was doing a job that mattered, although of course we all feel like we do it, was actually on 9/11. It was like the first time that I had that feeling of like, oh, this is as important as every other aspect of our society, was that day.
Yeah, absolutely, yeah.
And I know you covered it much more intensely than I did. Can we just back up for a second, though? What did you learn about how he lost his hand and his foot?
So the story that he told me, and my contact had told me before, gave me a little bit of a heads up, was that he lived in a Shabab neighborhood. And at that time, the city was completely divided up. And so they came recruiting. They asked him to join. And he told me that he said no. He was in school. He wanted to stay in school. And he didn't want to join the group. And that was a really brave thing to do, because I think we always have this misconception that, you know, the group is wildly popular and everyone believes in the ideology. And sure, that's true to some degree, but a lot of their recruits are just impoverished kids. They live in the neighborhood. It's like the mob, you know, you need to join for protection. You get a cell phone, probably get more money working with them than you would other groups. So it was pretty unusual and brave that he did this. They let him go, he told me, but then they came back for him the next day. And they kidnapped him. They said, you don't defy al-Shabaab. They took three other boys and they put them in prison for, I think it was about 28 days, harrowing conditions. At the end of that, they pulled him out to his stadium. And one by one, with people looking on, they amputated took off his hand and then his foot. Which is just, you know, I've said that story so many times, I've covered his story, but when you think about it and you look at the pictures from that day, which we had, the Associated Press had a photo of the four boys standing there before and after. It's pretty hard to believe.
And in your movie, he describes what it felt like. And it was interesting to me. I mean, it was hard to listen to. And of course, you have to remind yourself he was 17, but he talks about like electric shocks.
Yeah. And it was really interesting when we did that, because when we did the filming for when he talks about that story, it was kind of the most animated and emotional that he's ever been in all the years he told that story. And, you know, he told it to me originally, but then, as we'll probably get into, we kept in touch and his story grew and he told it over and over again. But yeah, in that interview, he says, you know, it was just like when you hit your elbow and, you know, when you get that weird sort of jolt, that's what it felt like. And then I believe he kind of passed out when the foot was taken. But then the crazy thing is that they kept him after that. So first of all, I always think it's amazing that these boys didn't die. But, you know, Shabab actually has doctors. They have medicine. So they kept them alive. They took him back to a safe house. And then what he told me was about 3 months later, he managed to escape. He convinced a cab driver to drop them off. He escaped. And then after he escaped, he made his way to the government where he found, you know, he found refuge there. And then that's when I met him.
And then talk about reaction. I mean, this story, yeah. Your Canadian readership reacted in a way that you didn't expect.
I didn't expect because, as I was saying, I had gotten a little cynical. And, you know, I remember covering like the Somali famine once and it was like, thousands of children were dying. It was harrowing. I came back and there was a story about puppies who had been rescued from Puerto Rico the same day. And the Star phones lit up. I mean, I think it was hundreds of people called and I think I got one call about, and I love dogs. I mean, I read that story, but I got, you know, one call. So I was getting sort
of... I adopted a dog
from Puerto Rico. Absolutely. But it was hard not to get cynical. But it had a reaction and it started with the Somali diaspora here. You know, they called me right away. They're like, what can we do? And then other readers chimed in, you know, how can we help? And then it was one person in particular who was a friend of mine, this incredible man who's in the film. He ended up producing the film with me. His name's Sahal Abdul, same last name, but no relation. And he's a Canadian Somali journalist. He had survived a terrible attack years ago, got PTSD, sort of left journalism. And he called me and he said, you know, I can't save Somalia, but I think I can save Ismail. And he set out to do that. And he did. Like, he unofficially got him out of Mogadishu, smuggled him into Nairobi, unofficially adopted him. And then story goes from there.
Tell me where the story goes from there.
Right. So Sahal said he was going to save him. So he was prepared to have him live with him in Nairobi for as long as it takes. You know, I went back 9 months later when he rescued him, did that story, was there with him in Nairobi. And then I went back to Toronto thinking, okay, well, he'll be there for a while. And it was just 3 months later, I get this call. And Sahal's like, are you sitting down? I was like, yes. He's like, we got, you know, refuge for Ismail. I've got the UN to agree, UNHCR to agree. And I was like, that's incredible. Where's he going? It's like, Norway. Because we had hoped he maybe would come to Canada. I'm like, okay, Norway. And he's like, I'm like, where? Oslo? He's like, no, Harstad, Norway. So I'm like pulling up a map. I'm like, that's 200 kilometers north of the Arctic Circle. And he's like, I know. So 3 months after that call, I went with Ismail and Sahal, like 200 kilometers north of the Arctic Circle to this beautiful little town called Harstad. And at that time, it was January. So it was a year after I'd met him. January 2011 is when he went there. And it was the time when there's no light, right? So you can just imagine this culture shock.
Yeah.
You know, this kid who's never seen snow before, never been outside of Mogadishu. I mean, Nairobi was a culture shock for him to arrive there and just think what happened. But, you know, he thrived. Like, it was an amazing community there. At that time, they had like an incredible support system for refugees. They embraced him. He learned Norwegian really quickly, started to join a soccer league. He was in school, finishing his high school. He did really well. And I kept going back and visiting him, you know, sometimes for stories. I had a film that was once in an Oslo film festival. He came down and met me, and then we went back. So we developed this relationship over about 10 years where I would update people on his story. And his story grew well beyond the Toronto Star. I mean, New York Times covered it, Guardian. He was a celebrity kind of in Norway. He just kept telling his story over and over again.
And your relationship with him, you stayed the journalist, but you sort of moved past that, right?
Yeah, it's hard. Like, yeah. You know, you have this sometimes. And I used to think you never did that. Like, there was always a very solid line. And because we learned that in journalism school, right?
Yeah.
I mean, when we were in journalism school way back when,
yeah.
I mean, you were taught that. It was objectivity, objectivity, objectivity. And I think it was probably before this case, but this case definitely brought it home that I'm like, no, that doesn't exist. I mean, everybody comes to stories with the lenses that you come and you have to acknowledge them. But also it's unnatural, especially when you're following someone for so long. And then, of course, later when I ended up doing the documentary, to not have some sort of friendship. So I don't really know the word to describe it. Was it a friendship? It was like, I was like a big sister to him. I'm not sure what it was. But we enjoyed each other's company, you know? We would see each other when we could. And yet, I was always still writing stories. You know, I wrote a book, and he was in the book. I dedicated the book to him. And there was always still that relationship, that power imbalance, really, even though we had a friendship.
And then I remember actually quite clearly when things started to kind of shift with him.
Yeah.
And you started to talk about, you just weren't sure what was going on, that he was...
It was when I did the documentary.
Yeah.
Yeah, it was up until that point, and he had wanted to do a documentary. He'd been pushing. And...
So let's just back up to make people...
Yeah.
So you decided with him that you were going to do a documentary about his life.
Right. So he had really wanted to do one. He knew that I was doing documentaries. At that point, I was starting to transition away from the Toronto Star and go independent and get more into filmmaking. So I was like, sure, this is great. We had TVO come on board first and NFB, and they really liked the idea a little bit of our relationship, which I did not want to do, quite frankly, because I did not want to be a part of the I was like, okay, I can maybe narrate this, but I really don't want to be in it. So I kind of remember having these conversations being like, yeah, it'll be our relationship. And then, you know, as you start filming, I'm like, nah, I'm not going to be in it that much. But I remember us talking about it because I would ask your advice, you know, as my friend and as another journalist. I'm like, I feel like every time the camera goes on, he's performing because he's so, like, you've met him, right?
Mm-hmm.
He's so genuine and he's so sweet and he seems so real and he's funny and and a lot of that was coming out on camera, but it was almost like we had a very on off. So like, okay, the camera's on, now we're filming. And you try not to do that in documentaries, right? You try and be as natural as possible.
Yeah.
And always. So I knew something was up. We had him in Toronto. We did some filming there. We did some filming in Norway. And then we were building towards him going back to Mogadishu for the first time. And that was always going to be part of the doc, that we would film that trip back. He hadn't been since he fled. First time he'd seen his family in 10 years. And so we knew it was going to be really emotional. It's also very logistically difficult to travel there. So it was really when we got there, after one or two days of filming, I'm like, something is up. And Sahal, who was also there, you know, there's a point in the film where he's actually saying, he's not telling us something. Like, I don't know what's happening here. And he was really kind of getting angry almost. And you can see it in the film. And I tell you, it was really uncomfortable to put it in because it's awful. It doesn't, I think it makes me look terrible because you see this tension. It's like I'm kind of forcing him to answer questions and he doesn't want to.
Everything about him changed.
Yeah.
You started to see his body language change.
Yeah.
It was obvious something was happening inside of him. When did you start to kind of think that you knew what it was, or did he give you an indication that? Because there was, in the end, we find out, and we'll get to that, that there was a real reason why he was anxious about it. How did that sort of come to be? Tell us that story.
Yeah, I mean, at first I was like, okay, this is just traumatic, and this is trauma. And I had spoken to a friend of mine before I left about, who is a wonderful forensic psychiatrist who works with people with PTSD, works with journalists. And I just asking, you know, what should I be careful? I don't want to trigger anything for him. Like, I was letting him very much drive what was happening.
Yeah.
But he wanted to do, there was never anything that he didn't want to do. But so at first I was just like, it's just the trauma of this. But I started to feel guilty in a weird way too. I was like, I think in a way, if I could have stopped the film then I might have, you know, like it was feeling really uncomfortable, and it had never felt uncomfortable with him. Like, I was making him do something that was hurting him.
I remember you were uncomfortable even before you went to Mogadishu. because you were uncomfortable with him being there. You were uncomfortable with how long he wanted to stay. Like there, it was already starting. Like it was, you were unsure as to like how he would do there and how long he wanted to be there.
Well, because we worried he was still at huge risk because here he was someone who had defied the Shabaab. He's coming back. He's in their face. They still have a presence in Mogadishu. Nothing like when he was there before, but there's still attacks. He could have easily been targeted. But it was also a terrible, you know, I talked about the power imbalance. Terrible when you were there because of the way it is there security-wise and because we were a film crew. We stayed at a fortified hotel where, you know, the UN stays and most foreigners. It's very rare for foreigners at that time anyway to go out in the city. So we went out with armed gunmen. Like you have to have security there. But it was a gross power imbalance because everything we were doing was because we could afford it. And Ismail couldn't afford that, right? But he was with us. And just by nature of that, you're not getting something that's natural because we are changing the situation. So all that felt really gross in a way that it's a reality, unfortunately, with a lot of foreign correspondents and the work you do. But it really felt gross that trip. I was hugely uncomfortable. And you could tell he was uncomfortable. And yeah, we left there that week and he decided he wanted to stay way longer. And we were paying for him to fly there and back. And he wanted us to change the ticket. And I was like, you're at risk here. Don't. Like, please, like, listen to your mom. Listen to Sahal. What do I know? But listen to these people who, like, understand the situation really well. Your mom doesn't want you to stay. Sahal doesn't want you to stay. All the security advisors don't. So we left not really knowing. He was staying on, obviously. We left not knowing what would happen. And then got back to Toronto. And I would get weird texts from him. We were supposed to kind of Skype all the time. Communication started to dwindle. And then he kept saying, can you extend my trip? Can you extend my trip? So I can't remember exactly now how much it was, but I think he was supposed to go for 2 weeks and ended up being 3 months.
And his mom eventually sends him home.
His mom was like, go home.
Yeah.
Yeah.
It's too
dangerous. At some point she's like, that was the text we got saying, my mom wants me to go now. So I have to, can you go? And then the plan was we would meet him in Amsterdam on his connection and then film him going back to Norway. And he sent me a text saying, the film is not happening. You can meet me in Amsterdam, but don't bring cameras. So that's what I did.
A young correctional officer.
He said it was the most dangerous prison in California.
Forced to make a choice. Fulfill his oath or back his fellow officers.
Recognize the badge of my office.
I'm Suki Lewis from KQED Podcasts comes On Our Watch Season 2, New Folsom. A story about who gets hurt when the system that promises to keep us safe is bent on protecting itself. Find it wherever you listen to podcasts.
And then you find out eventually that he's got something to tell you about his story.
Yeah, it was in Amsterdam. And he said, we're like, what is happening? We know something's happening. And he, not on camera, because I went with producer Bryn Hughes and we didn't, you know, honored his wishes, didn't bring the camera. And he just said, I've been living a lie for 10 years. I told you a lie. And I remember I started crying, which is like ridiculously unprofessional. But I was just, it was starting to make sense. I was like, oh, I am a part of something that's going to come right now and poor you. And he didn't give us many details, but he basically said, what I told you 10 years ago wasn't exactly the truth. And I instantly knew, oh, you told me that story and then you couldn't dial it back. It was like a chain of events that things had happened. So he went back to Norway. We went back to Toronto. We kind of put the film on hold for a while. And I was so lucky that it was actually a really, really amazing team. Like documentary filmmaking's not always the nicest business. And at the NFB and TVO, we had this, happened to be all women, this team of like incredibly patient, wonderful producers are like, let's just do what's best for him. Let's wait. And eventually he decided that he would tell the story and he would tell it on camera and we'd finish the film and that's how the film would change. So the film was completely different from what we set out to do. All of a sudden, I was a main character, which I hope to never do again in a film, but it felt disingenuous not to be a part of it. And then he came to Toronto for a really difficult week of filming. I mean, he was kind of angry in ways that I understand. And we did his interview over 2 days. Like, it was hours of him going through his story, telling it, taking breaks. And he basically, I mean, in the end, I really don't feel the lie was very significant, but it clearly had eaten him up for all those years. And what the real story was that he did live in a Shabab neighborhood, but he had been robbing people at a market. He had a gun. He had been with his friends, and Bakara Market's a very famous market in Mogadishu. And he had been there one day, and a Shabab member came up, someone that knew his brother, and said, "Can I see your gun?" And he's like, "Sure." And he handed him the gun, and he pointed at him and said, "Okay, you're a thief, and under Sharia law, we punish thieves. So now you're under arrest." So they took him into custody. All that part was true. Obviously, they still did the same barbaric act to him. And then the other part of the story that changed was that when he was, he told me he had escaped, which always was a little bit, like the story was always a little bit thin on details. I do remember that part being like, but how did you escape? And what happened? Anyway, that part of the story wasn't true. What ended up happening was they held him for 3 months and then they returned him home with $50 and to his family. And he, I mean, this is the part that amazes me. At 17 years old, he knows that he's a double amputee. He is, you know, has almost no prospects there. So he makes his way to the government. He convinces them, because everybody, like the justice minister, you know, my contact who is the justice minister's spokesperson, they didn't think that that part of the story wouldn't be true. So he seeks refuge there. He convinces them that this is the story. And then I just happen to be in Mogadishu and the one that he tells it to.
I mean, even as a 17-year-old, to realize that he has to tell you a story that is sort of the perfect victim story versus the truth is quite genius of a young man who...
It's astute, right? And this is where we all come into the story. And this is what we tried to do in the film, that it's like, it's not... He understood that we crave those kind of simple stories. And I was embarrassed because I always thought, oh no, I'm a national security reporter who does difficult Guantanamo Bay stories and other stories that have nuance, and I don't tell the very simple narratives. But I was drawn to this story because it was a simple narrative. You know, it was a classic young kid hero. But I, you know, I think generally as a society, we have certain expectations of how people are supposed to behave. And, you know, in Canada here, we've had an influx of Syrian refugees, and we all want the story of the Syrian restaurant owner who is making good of it and now becoming this success, not the Syrian refugee who's like, it's really difficult here. I have mental health issues and I can't afford this, and et cetera. Like, we want a certain story. And he knew that. He knew that he wouldn't get the same empathy if he told what really happened. And he's probably right. Like, I know I've been asked, would you still write the story? Absolutely. I mean, it's still, what happened to him was barbaric. He was still a way into a larger story about Shabab and what was happening at the time. But would it have generated the same outpouring? I'm not sure it would have. You know, I don't know if his fate would have been changed the same way.
You say you would have told it, but was it your place to tell it? Should it have been somebody else telling that story?
Well, that's the other question that all of this raised. Like, in a way, the story made me rethink what we do as foreign correspondents when we parachute in and out anyway.
Because I remember us really talking about how impossible it would be to fact check so much of what happens there. Not even just him, but everything. And so it does make you wonder, like, who should be the one telling those stories when it's so hard to know what's really going on or what the truth is?
It's such a larger question, I think, generally in a larger journalism question. I think generally, you know, in terms of foreign storytelling, what we try and do now is, you know, support local journalists and empower that. And that's, and I think since 2010, that has been, so much has changed journalism wise that has become a reality. And that's wonderful, because I'm going to tell a different story than a Somali journalist is 100%. We're going to have different access. But I don't think it means that you can't have I hope it doesn't mean that you can't have foreign correspondents going into countries, because the lens that I brought was different in an important way too. I mean, I would bring, what I liked about always being based here and going to various countries is I would work with local journalists that would often really help, like tremendously help in understanding the context. But I also knew what people were looking at here. You know, I knew the Canadian policies and what stories would matter to people and how you could tell them in a way that it would make them care, I hoped, anyway.
Well, and I don't know if he would have gotten refugee status if it had been in a newspaper in another country.
No, but then
the power of the Somali community here.
Yeah, yeah, exactly.
And we're saying this quickly and you're talking about it, but this was fraught for you for months and months. Yeah. I mean, this wasn't an easy thing for you. Even you say, you know, it shifted and I accepted I was going to be part of the story. That was so hard.
It was horrible because you're really, you know, first of all, you have written something that isn't true. You know, that's the cardinal sin in journalism. So I knew I had to correct the record. That's hard to do. Even though in hindsight, I don't think there was any way that I could have fact checked it differently. And also, I think I had a duty of care, as you do when you're in the field, to those who've been traumatized. And it's not my role to go in and interrogate him. Like, why would I think that part of his story wasn't true? But still, you're out there saying, hey, I reported a story. So that was hard. But yeah, just the queasy feeling of all the different things that it brings up in terms of what we do as foreign journalists, what we do as journalists.
And you were worried about the response.
I was worried about the response for a whole bunch of reasons. Like one, that I worried it would smack of some sort of gross white saviorism, you know, which I always made it clear it wasn't the Toronto Star and it wasn't my reporting. Like it was the Somali diaspora that did this. But of course, there's that gross feeling, right? I'm still the white director and journalist telling this boy's story.
Yeah.
So that's uncomfortable. But I did worry about the reaction too, that if we didn't tell the story properly, and thankfully this didn't happen, but I was worried what would happen to him. You know, at a time when there's incredible xenophobia, was he going to have his citizenship, his Norwegian citizenship taken from him? Would people, you know, right-wingers be like, see, all refugees lie? You know, would it give fodder to that? And also at a time when, you know, media is so under fire and cries of fake news, would it give fodder to the fact that, see, they never get it right? So, yeah, I've never disliked a project more. You know, it felt this sort of gross, like, let's get through this. I feel like it's responsible to correct the record. That actually gives you credibility in journalism. He wants to do this. He needs to get this off his chest. But yeah, I think you remember this. It's like when the film came out, I was like, okay, let's just have a quick screening and then like go away.
Yeah, be done with it.
And be done, yeah.
But the response actually wasn't...
It was lovely.
Yeah.
I know, I was so happy because... it was great. I mean, we had it at Hot Docs for a couple nights and it was, sold out theater. It was beautiful crowd. People understood, really thoughtful questions, difficult questions, stuff I think like still working through, but like smart response, you know, a couple tiny instances of what I worried about, you know, the xenophobia and stuff, but very minor. And then nothing came of harm to him, which was the most important.
And I know you don't like to, you're embarrassed by it, but this telling of this was so well done. It was so real and human, and it added to the story in a way that I think if it had been always told in the truth, I'm not sure we would have even gotten as much out of it.
Maybe. Yeah. I mean, it was, I'm not saying this to be like modest, but it really was a film that it's like, I was the least important part. Like we had Nick Hector was our editor and he was incredible. Like it was because I was so involved in it. And then Bryn and others, like it was, and Sahal, of course, like I was so involved in it. I didn't have any perspective to even kind of figure out how to do the film. So it was a heavy lift from everybody on it. But in the end, I think once I finally got over the queasiness, I hate the word important. It sounds so.
Oh, it was an important journalism story to tell. Like it beyond you and beyond the story, it was an important journalism story to tell because there's lessons to be learned from what happened.
I think you can show it in journalism schools. Like that would be the ideal. And then just let it spark a discussion, you know, because it brings up all these questions that it took me 20 years into my career to really, you know, face.
Yeah. Has he seen the film?
Mm-hmm. We watched it online. So it was during COVID at the end. Because otherwise I would have gone to Norway and showed it to him in person, but we watched it together online because, and again, this is a weird journalism thing. Normally you never do this, but we didn't feel comfortable with it releasing it until he'd seen it. You don't do that. You don't show a subject a film. You certainly on condition of like releasing it, but yeah, we did that.
And what did he think?
He actually really liked it. He did. I mean, we recorded that too. It was all getting very meta. I was like, are we going to include that in there? We didn't in the film, but he was surprised because it's hard. I don't think he always realized it was going to be more about journalism and the question of that than about him. But in the end, he said he liked it and he was bracing for the reaction as well. He already said, you know, some people are really going to get this and some people aren't. And I'm like, yeah, you're probably right. And luckily the people who didn't get it was a much smaller group than the people who did. But since then, I mean, I offered to bring him here for the screenings and he didn't want to do any of that. And as far as I know, he hasn't done any interviews on it. And unfortunately, our relationship really kind of severed after that. We stayed in touch, but recently he at one point's like, you know what, every time I talk to you, it just reminds me of this. And that's absolutely fair. So I haven't talked to him now in quite a while.
Sad, but also brave of him to do it. And then brave of him to say, I need to move on.
Totally. Yeah. Totally. And he did need to. I mean, that identified him for so many years. Yeah.
Okay. Well, Michelle, thanks.
Thank you for having me, Kathleen.
You've been listening to Crime Story from CBC Podcasts. We drop a new episode every Monday. You can get our next episode a week early on CBC Podcasts' YouTube channel or by subscribing to the CBC Podcasts True Crime channel on Apple Podcasts. In addition to early access, subscribers to our True Crime channel also listen ad-free. Crime Story is written and hosted by me. Our producers are Alexis Green and Sarah Clayton. Sound design by Graham McDonald. Our senior producer is Jeff Turner. Our video producer is Evan Agard. Our YouTube producer is John Lee. Executive producers are Cecil Fernandez and Chris Oak. Tanya Springer is CBC Podcast Senior Manager, and Arif Narani is the Director of CBC Podcasts.
For more CBC podcasts, go to cbc.ca/podcasts.